You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Show your support for KBOO programming by picking up the special limited edition 2022 Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. Flaunt your love of bluegrass and KBOO with the stylish royal blue and neon yellow tee. Get yours now at kboo.fm/bgshirt.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Rachel Haynes, broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Co-host Steven Siegel is at a conference, but both of us are public school teachers and host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. Joining us today are Angela Bonilla, Emily Goldenfields, and Jackie Dixon. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Great. So let's start with Angela and then go to Emily and Jackie. Can you tell us about your teaching background and experience?
Yes, this is Angela. I am an instructional coach currently at a elementary school in Northeast Portland. I have been teaching for Portland Public Schools for about 6 years, but I've worked with infants all the way to college students, both within the classroom and through organizing and other work.
Hi, this is Emily. I was an ESL teacher for a number of years abroad and in New York City, and I kind of took a circuitous path back to education. Through law school, which was a huge mistake. So I was a lawyer for a while, and then had some kids, got a teaching license, and I've been a substitute in Portland Public Schools for about 6 years as well.
Hi, this is Jackie. I'm a school climate specialist currently with the DART program in Portland Public Schools. So those are day and residential treatment settings for youth. And I've been a language arts, ESL, and ethnic studies teacher for about 17 years in PPS.
Excellent. And do any of you currently serve in any elected positions in your union?
Yes, this is Angela again. I am currently on the executive board for Portland's Association of Teachers, as well as on the bargaining team, and I'm the president-elect of PAT.
Hi, this is Jackie again, and I'm currently also on the executive board, and I work with the Racial Equity Committee, and I'm the vice president-elect.
All right, and Emily.
I am not currently serving any elected positions, but I am a member at large, director at large, elect of the executive board of PAT.
All right. Congratulations to all three of you. And you're all members of a caucus, PCOR, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators. Can you just tell us a little bit about your involvement in this caucus? Full disclosure, I am a member.
Hi, this is Jackie again. I honestly, I can't remember whether it was you or Alicia. Some of my teacher friends in PAT introduced me to PCOR, and what really attracted me to PCOR is the idea of organizing and working hand in hand with our rank and file members. So the idea behind PCOR is rank and file members coming together and organizing, and I feel like that's where our power is at in a union.
This is Angela. I actually only joined PCOR recently from a teacher friend, a slightly radical teacher friend who invited me. And my biggest question when I joined PCOR was like, why isn't this what a union is? Like, why is this separate? And so I guess my involvement really was more of like joining to better understand why there needed to be a separate space for this kind of work, and if there were any ways that we could have our union do this work for, you know, within the union, as opposed to having to be something that's external. So really mostly learning.
How about you, Emily?
Yeah, this is Emily again. I joined Peace Corps a number of years ago, and a lot of it was because it was Peace Corps members who I saw as the most visible organizers in the teachers union. So they were, Peace Corps has been a caucus that has been kind of doing what it says it wants to do. So members are out there supporting families, building bonds with communities, fighting for democratic unionism, having kind of more of public outward facing messaging about why public education is important, pedagogy that supports students, you know, liberatory pedagogy, kind of all the planks of Peace Corps slate are what the members of Peace Corps outwardly fight for. So it was just a pretty natural gravitation.
Well, you were all, as you said, recently elected to serve in leadership positions in PAT. And this wasn't a typical election season. Usually there aren't contested races for president and vice president. And can you speak a little bit about this and why this election was different? How about, I'm going to direct this first to Jackie, since you were in a pretty hotly contested race.
Yeah. Well, I was running against, or really for our union, but against the incumbent or current vice president, which, like you said, is unusual. I think it's kind of sad, actually, that it is unusual, and I'm not sure why union elections usually go that way, whereas most other political elections, there's not just one person running. So I think we had to campaign a lot more than what's typical for a vice president or presidential election. And I think it was a great learning experience, and it brought a lot of our members together, actually, and I think helped me form relationships, stronger bonds than relationships with our current members.
This is Angela. I was running uncontested. The current president chose not to run, but I have not held elected positions within PAT except for as an executive board member. And I'm halfway through that term. So it was pretty unusual that someone without that, like, you know, training and pruning and building into the leadership running for the highest office. But I think, you know, this election was a little different because we are in very different times. I mean, I know when our current elected officials, our officers were elected, no one was thinking about COVID. So I think this election had a lot more folks engaged and interested because we've had to do so much work as a union around COVID protections and reopening of schools that members were kind of more on the pulse than they typically were.
Mm-hmm. And can you all talk about your decision to run as a slate? And how about I start with Emily for that one?
Well, I think running as a slate, I wasn't there in the initial decisions, so I can hand that one off. But I think running as a slate is really a powerful way to run. I think it shows when you can direct what you're fighting for back to planks of what you believe in, I think it really crystallizes what you're doing, what you want to fight for, how it's different, contrasting it to the current membership or the current leadership. And I think it's really important. Angela was hitting on this of why, and Jackie too, of contested elections are great. I think they show that people care about an organization, they care about the union and want to put out their different visions. And I think a slate is a really powerful way of putting out your vision of how you want to kind of change course. And in this case, it was really amazing to see basically every member of the slate be elected. So clearly the membership, that vision really hit with the membership and they wanted to see a new course.
And actually, that's a great segue to the next question. what were those planks, or what were some of the issues that you ran on? Angela, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. There were several planks, but I think the all of these kind of issues or ideas that we ran on grew from conversations with educators, right? What were we hearing consistently from folks about the union that they felt wasn't serving them? So one of our big planks was ensuring that this union was for everyone, that everyone felt included. And so some of the things that we've been discussing is finding ways to have more listening sessions and committees for our educators who don't often feel represented, which is mostly non-classroom educators. So, you know, there's the piece of organizing and communication. We haven't had a structure that was very transparent for folks. And sometimes there are things that I'm privy to because I'm on the bargaining team or on the executive board that aren't top secret, but most of the membership doesn't know about. And so as an educator, my mindset is, well, we should be teaching people, right? We should educate them and inform them about what's going on so that they can make better, more informed choices. Because there are certain pieces that are, you know, legalities, but there are also pieces that are just cultural to our organization, that when you have 30 to 40% of probationary teachers on your at the district, most folks haven't had experience with. So really better communication, better organizing, and better connection amongst members. But Jackie?
Just to kind of build on what Angela was talking about, I think one piece that really excites me is the community organizing. Our teachers, like across the district at different schools, are doing so much amazing work, and a lot of it is happening in silos rather than together. So as a union, I'm really excited to support that work that I know is already being done, and also create some long-term partnerships and lasting bonds with our community. I think we talk about it a lot and we try, but we just, throughout the years, I've kind of seen, it's like we'll do an event here or there with a community partner, and then there's no like long-term commitment with that community. And we know that organizing as a union, if we're going to put our students and our members and our communities, our families first, then we have to be there for them during their fights and for the things that are important to them as a community. We can't just ask them for help when we need help as teachers organizing. So I'm excited about, you know, continuing and building on those partnerships.
How about you, Emily?
The main thing that I would like to see is for our union to get strike ready. I think that the power that we have is going on strike. And I've done, you know, a lot of electoral organizing, and I think that there are absolutely places for us to be partnering, especially demanding that the state and legislators like move forward on, maybe that's a good place for class size reductions. You know, legislature needs to support us in real ways with revenue and legislation, but our power is withholding our labor. And if we don't have the connections that Jackie was talking about with our community, we can't win on that. If we don't have those bonds where we know that we are together with our students, their families, and our communities against a district that is absolutely trying to decimate public education, cut teachers, not provide us with the supports and services that we need for quality education, we have to do it for ourselves. And we actually have in common the best interest of society and our students and our families. And so if we can organize in that way and organize building by building and have a messaging and communications, a way of really distilling what that fight is and which side we're on, we can win, and we can keep winning, and we can actually make a difference in the lives of society generally, because education is that important.
Yeah. So you touched on some of the things that are attacks on public education, And PPS has presented a budget that proposes cutting around 120 positions next year. So can y'all talk about how this looks across the district in terms of class size and the impact on students? And please put this in the context of the academic and social and emotional needs of students after 2 years of an ongoing pandemic. Jackie, you want to start with this one?
Sure. I think like Angela was touching on earlier, some of the spaces I've been in recently, just choosing to volunteer my time actually and show up to like the PBS budget work session, for example, it was really enlightening, I guess, to be there and kind of understand what is some of their messaging around these cuts from the. So I want transparency for our members. I think right now the process is not clear to our members and it's not clear to our communities. So like what we're viewing as cuts, they're saying there are less than what is being communicated. They're saying they're actually going to hire people in the fall. And I would like to work with the district just to improve that transparency. So, you know, the last thing when teacher morale we know is down and people are suffering and have worked so hard to you know, help reintroduce our students to in-person education and focus on socio-emotional learning and bring people together. And, you know, you've got teachers doing the job of teacher, counselor, social worker. And then we've got counselors and social workers as well, but just the things that we're seeing in our day-to-day, it's stressful, it's very stressful. So the last thing that we want our members to have to deal with is fearing like, oh, I'm gonna lose my job now. Right, especially in a time when the state budget is allocating more money for education than in a typical year, or more than we actually had budgeted previously. So I kind of feel like I just talked in a circle there, but I guess my point is I think we need more transparency about how does this hiring and firing or transferring actually work. And long term, I'm really curious about how we can change that process so that people we get unassigned like they are currently, and then potentially go to another district. I mean, if we're really worried about being able to fill all of these education positions, I don't understand why folks are unassigned and relocated, and if in the long run they're going to be hiring supposedly more educators.
Yeah, there's a couple of pieces that are very difficult to understand with this whole situation for the public. And I agree with Jackie that it's really important that PPS clarifies their systems, because there are positions that are in district administration or that work to support schools but aren't located in schools that are not educator positions that are also are being funded, but classroom educators are being cut, right? And so the first thing to understand is that we have been understaffed all year. So we have had positions that have been open since the beginning of the year that no one has been hired for. They are cutting those positions. So when we think about it as, it's just rearranging some teachers, the reality is they're cutting positions by choosing to not fill them. So when someone's retired and you say, okay, good luck, bon voyage, and then never fill that position, that's a cut. So that's where we need to start. They're already cutting from what we hoped to have this year to support our kids after 2 years of having to do distance learning. Then on top of that, they're cutting positions of educators who've actually been here, who were hired into positions. Including special education educators, including English language learning educators. And so the kids who need the most are losing even more than our students who are, you know, neurotypical, you know, primarily English learners in our schools. The other piece is that recently at that budget meeting that Jackie and I were at, they were pushing back against the notion that PPS is trying to staff all of our classes at the largest number. And they're like, well, we only have a handful of schools where the class sizes will be at the like peak limit class size for their own calculations, not calculations we made as educators who are on the ground doing the work, but calculations they made at the district level. And that's true, but there are multiple classrooms who have one less than the highest limit, two students less than the highest limit. And so we know those a classroom of 25 students in kindergarten is not a safe classroom. It's not a classroom where every kid is going to be able to feel as served as that teacher could make them feel had they had less students, right? And so we're losing educators. We're losing educators that are students who need the most service are losing. We're putting kids in positions where they're going to be feeling less served. And then on top of that, we have a school district right now that is deciding to cut positions and cut classrooms midway through the year, and no one knows how those decisions are made, right? We have a lot of folks who are trying to figure out what's my next move, and we could be losing educators when we already have a shortage. I am usually a dual language immersion teacher, and we would have folks cut at the end of the year and say, we don't need that extra classroom. Then in the fall, they go, oh, whoops, all these kids we forgot about now are here. We need another teacher. And all those highly skilled teachers are already hired at other districts. So that's how we lose all these educators here at PPS, is when we do these preemptive cuts and then try to bring them back. And so we have to make sure that PPS values our students by keeping our highly trained educators who want to be here, here for them.
And just a clarifying question about the high class sizes. So when they're talking about there are only a handful that are at the maximum amount, they're not taking into consideration how many schools across the district who have already reported that with their cuts, they're going to have class sizes like second grade at 33 kids in a class, or third grade, you know, 35 or 31. I mean, even if it's not the highest threshold, those are incredibly high classrooms. And that is not a handful. Am I correct in that?
Yes. And the other thing that folks don't understand that plays on that point is that the district has decided that none of the students who have not returned from the last 2 years will come back. So these projections are based on every student who's left during COVID, their family saying, you know what, I want to homeschool my kid for the rest of our career, mm-hmm. or I want to send them to this charter school for the rest of this time. And so because of that, these class sizes that are even projected to be 20 kids in kindergarten are likely to be a lot larger now that we have vaccinations for 5-12, and now that folks have seen what school has been like during COVID. So that's the other piece to consider.
And when PPS messages about average class size, the other piece is they're not including some of our focus classrooms, which have very low class numbers for a reason. So like if there's only 7 students in a class, it's an intensive skills class, or one of the language programs that's a specialty language program, that's bringing down the average class size number down significantly. So it makes it look like, oh, well, there's only about 20 kids or 25 kids in these classes, when that's just not the reality.
And so in our last few minutes, this is a pretty big question, but what are some of the biggest issues that you think that educators and students face here in PPS and public education in general? How can we strengthen and protect public education? How about I throw this to you, Emily? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I think that what we're seeing with these cuts, and we see it happening in New York, we see it happening, it just happened in Minneapolis. Minneapolis teachers are on strike around the same situation of this. There's this discrepancy between huge surplus and wealth. We're looking at a state, we're looking at a city which has luxury condos going up on every block. We know that there are huge amounts of budget surpluses. That's what our legislators are telling us. Yet we are cutting positions. And it just is like a moral discrepancy. There's an unconscionability of, we know there's wealth, yet we are pretending there's scarcity. And I think we need to call out any elected official in any district that is selling us this, because we have to put this in the context of 30 years of underfunding of public schools. We have so deprived students and teachers and all the support staff of having a decent workable situation for so many decades, that to continue pretending like there isn't enough and that we need to make cuts, it's really hard to see as anything other than just eroding and trying to demoralize educators, demoralize parents, and just privatize education. So we have to fight these absolutely baseless cuts and fight for more revenue. And that's every student deserves to have a small class. Every teacher deserves a dignified retirement. I mean, these are just basic, in my mind, moral, you know, conscionable ways that we as a society should be operating. And people want these things. They want levies. They want bonds. They want education to be funded. So there's no real question about that.
Anyone else want to chime in real quick? Last comment?
I think Emily has it spot on. What we know is that when we have great public schools, it serves society as a whole. Most social ills start from a lack of service and support early on. And schools are the first interactions most communities have with government and the rest of society. So when we have great public schools for everyone, we are building towards a greater society for everyone. So we need fully funded schools, fully supported schools, and communities that feel like the school is theirs, because it is, because public school is for everyone.
Beautiful notes to end on. Thank you so much, Angela, Emily, and Jackie, for joining us on KBOO tonight. And thank you, Jamie Partridge, for making a radio ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. to catch another Labor Radio show.
bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline. Produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. The second annual Day of Empathy was held on March 30th. It was organized by the Family Preservation Project, who connects children with their incarcerated mothers in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's only women's prison, and by the national nonprofit Dream Corps Justice. This year, mothers